I feel like this time I'm just going to shuffle a lot of papers.
Oh, you're going to be like Rush Limbaugh?
And hope that it lends me an air of credibility.
No. When I was in, I guess although...
You don't even have your novel in front of you.
It's all in here.
Poor student.
Oh, sure. Okay. Well, I'm glad you're saving this for before the pod.
No, that's actually how we're going to start it. Welcome to the Literary Hangover, everybody. I'm your host, Matt Leck. With me is Alex Guns.
Yeah, hi.
And Grace.
Hi.
And we are once again, we're covering Hope Leslie by Catherine Maria Sedgwick, 1827 novel. And Alex was being reprimanded by Grace. For being a less than diligent student, isn't that correct?
The book is in the room. I feel like I'll go fetch it if I need it. This is confidence. This
Alex
is literary
only
confidence.
Has his notebook in front of him.
See, that I have a triangle though right here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we didn't restrict, you know, materials for reference. This isn't a test.
Oh, this
really?
Is cool. I like this part two episode where it's like, let's all make Alex feel subconscious. Well, it's not going to work because I was doing it to myself on the train before I got here.
Because there's diminishing returns.
Yeah. Get in line,
to how
guys.
Self-conscious you can be.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of, well, maybe not self-conscious, but ancestral consciousness, we're going to start off with some biographical details on Catherine Maria Sedgwick. Prompted by this article, Reading and Writing Hope Leslie, Catherine Maria Sedgwick's Indian Connections by Karen Woods Weirman. And if I had the print information for this, I would say it right now.
I have it.
Do you?
Oh my God, shut the fuck up. I have it.
This is from the New England Quarterly, Volume 75, which was published in September 2002.
There we go, 2002.
Yeah.
All right. And it goes into three sort of different Indian removals that Catherine Maria Sedgwick is connected to by DNA. Well, maybe not a removal, but the first one is her cousin Eunice Williams, who was a resident of Deerfield, Massachusetts, along with her family, which was the site of a 1704 attack by French and Indian troops, which was called the Deerfield Massacre, left 39 dead, captured 112. And among those captured were Eunice, her father, some of her siblings, and her mother, who died on the march up to Canada. Now, the rest of the family was redeemed, I guess I would say, or ransomed, saved by the French-Canadian authorities. However, Eunice married a Catholic Mohawk in 1713. I'm just going to read from Weirman right now. Sedgwick's interest in that cultural conversation was not solely intellectual. Literary critic and historian Mary Kelly has suggested that Eunice Williams, a distant relation of Sedgwick's through her maternal grandfather Abigail Williams, Sergeant Dwight, was an important source for the character of Faith Leslie. Eunice Williams's unusual experience was kept alive in local folklore, as well as in a best-selling captivity narrative, The Redeemed Captive Returning to Zion, a history John Damos had recounted in his... I'm going to skip that section. In 1704, a French and Indian war party attacked the town of Deerfield, Massachusetts. 39 residents were killed outright and 112 were captured. The Reverend John Williams' family was a special target. Two of the youngest children were killed at the house. Mrs. Williams was soon killed during a forced march to Canada, and the remaining five Williams children were taken captive by their father. Eunice Williams, aged 7 at the time of the raid, was the only Williams child who was not redeemed. She adopted Indian ways and in 1713 married Francois Xavier Arosin, a Kanawaki Mohawk and Catholic from the Montreal area. 36 years after being removed from Deerfield, Eunice visited her English relatives, a trip she repeated on three more occasions during her lifetime. Despite the best efforts of her family to redeem her for civilization, however, Eunice chose to remain loyal to her Indian family and her Catholic faith. She lived until 1785, dying just 4 years before Catherine Sedgwick's birth in 1789. And then her ancestors, Sedgwick was in occasional contact with them as well.
Well, this essay suggests that she might have been a source for the character of Faith Leslie, who marries Onico?
Yeah, Onico. Yeah. Onico? Well, that's how I pronounce it anyway. And I mentioned Eunice had some siblings that were also captured by the by the French and Indian War Party. Among those was her brother, and he was, as I mentioned, ransomed by the French governor. In 1734, he was in Stockbridge, Massachusetts, and one of the people to recommend that they open up a mission to try to missionize the Native Americans. So that's sort of one way to react to being captive is, well, I'm going to save them, bring them. I see how bad it is that these savages are not Christianized. So let's start this mission. And reading again from Weirman. In 1734-35, Reverend Stephen Williams was among those who proposed that an Indian mission to the Housatonic Indians be established at Stockbridge. Stephen Williams had been captured along with his sister Eunice, but he had been ransomed by the French governor. As Hilary Wiss contends, Williams' captivity led to his interest in Stockbridge, which allowed him to rhetorically redefine his own captivity through his paternalistic actions as a minister willing to save the heathens from their own religious captivity. But the mission could not erase Eunice's marriage, and as Wiss notes, this relationship haunts the early years of the Stockbridge mission. The first missionary, John Sargent, joked about English fears of, quote, going native, as he wrote to an unidentified friend in 1736, the year the mission town of 36 square miles was laid out, perhaps we shall be so taken with them and their way of living that we shall take each of us a wife from amongst, and sadly disappoint all other fairer ones that may have any expectation of us.
Yeah, I think in the book, or it touches on that fear that these Europeans are bringing with them a total and complete worldview that is their religious doctrine that has no room for anything else. And there's, you can see this kind of subconscious fear that interacting with this culture of people that haven't even been touched by medieval scholasticism, and what would happen if, like, and they're doing just fine, it would seem, and what would happen to their worldview if it was to come into contact with people who not only don't know about it, but also don't need it.
Mm.
And you can see that, I think, there's a number of discourses in the book where those people are challenged by having this airtight worldview run up against, like, a Native American, like Mega Whisker, someone who's like, actually, I'm pretty in tune with the world and my sense of reason without your doctrine, basically.
Yeah, it's if you remember in the last section when Maga Whiskas asked how she's feeling about being a new member of the household, mm-hmm. she's like, she mentions like I'm a bird in the air, a tree in the forest, sort of thing,
mm-hmm.
Sort of inscrutable to them. The group, this is from Weirman again, the group that eventually became known as the Stockbridge Indians was a composite community of Mohican bands from New York, Connecticut, and Massachusetts. The four English families who joined the town to serve as models of Christianity and, quote, civilization, end quote, included that headed by Ephraim Williams, a cousin of Stephen Williams and Catherine Sedgwick's great-grandfather. Now, basically, the Stockbridge community didn't work out. It didn't end up creating this that is a weird model, right? We're going to have four sort of patriarchal English families. The rest is going to be Native Americans, and they're just going to learn how to be Christian over, like,
I mean, yeah, it seems like a numbers game. You're going to want to have, if you're going to like implore some sort of like dictatorial rule on people's lives and even their own thoughts, you should probably have more than a handful of people.
And what eventually ended up happening was more and more English settlers moved to Stockbridge, and they basically edge out the Native Americans that were there. By over the course of the next 60 years, a lot of them would be excommunicated and their land would be sold. It's interesting that a lot of Sedgwick's family and those people, the whites that were controlling Stockbridge, basically just used it as a money funnel and a way to get land. And so despite the betrayal they suffered, the Stockbridge Indians rallied in support of the American Revolution. Colin Calloway notes that, quote, no Indian community gave the patriot cause more dedicated service than the town of Stockbridge. Back home, however, war widows were forced to sell land, and whites solidified their control of the local government. Ultimately, quote, the revolution brought the final separation of the Indians from both their American neighbors and their Stockbridge land. In 1783, the Stockbridge Indians, having been frustrated in every effort to secure their future in their community, informed the general court of their intentions. Quote, in this late war, we have suffered much. Our blood has been spilled with yours, and many of our young men have fallen by the side of your warriors. Now we who remain are become very poor. Now, brothers, we will let you know we have been invited by our brothers, the Oneidas, to go and live with them. We have accepted their invitation. They also sought the government's help in settling their affairs in Stockbridge. We will tell you now what we desire of you. We wish you and your wisdom to make some laws that will protect and guard us while we remain or hereafter have occasion to come into your government. We wish to have them directed carefully to examine into all our bargains for land that the white people have made with us and see that we haven't been cheated, that when we are ready to remove, we may feel well towards our neighbors. In other words, the Stockbridge Indians asked that whites friendly to their interests be appointed to examine land sales, past, present, and future, to certify their legality. And among those buying land from the Stockbridge war widows, or American Revolutionary War widows, Weirman continues, there is indeed a direct connection between the arrival of the Sedgwicks in Stockbridge and the departure of the Indians. Pamela Dwight, daughter of Joseph Dwight and Abigail Williams Sargent Dwight, had married Theodore Sedgwick of Cornwall, Connecticut in 1774. During the 1780s, no doubt acting upon tips from his Dwight Williams in-laws, Sedgwick participated in the final land grab as he bought at least four small parcels in Indian hands. Sedgwick bought his first property, site of what would become the Sedgwick Homestead on Main Street in 1785, from Elizabeth Wawampikwanot, a widow of Daniel, who was killed during the Revolution. So, again, like, I'm just a complete, like, small world sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But fingerprints all over. Another removal that I'd never even heard of. I've never heard of these Stockbridge Indians before. And the idea that they're... It's super gruesome that they would fight in the Revolution and their reward would be their what they were building in Stockbridge is finally like just destroyed and
yeah,
given
it's a
up
chance
on.
To finally get rid of them.
Yeah, exactly.
And also the fact that they were kind of earnestly trying to use the institutions of colonial rule in their favor. Like you say, they were trying to get their land... get the ownership of the land clarified and
good faith at every step of the way.
Totally.
Okay, fine. We'll go by your law. And actually we will get to that soon. Mega Wiska makes a comment on English law and it's complete, fiction if you're not on the right side of it. Basically.
Oh yeah. Well, I think that whole story is all over Hope Leslie, this making home and what is a home and, The quote we jumped off of on the last episode about the home can never be transferred. Part of that is like a sweet sentiment, how it's your emotional bonds and attachments to the people that raise you and things like that. And you can't emulate that anywhere else. But the other idea is that like home is not some static place, that you're bringing with you a set of ideas and space that you need to construct this. And in a world with limited space, you're going to push out other people. So a home can't be transferred in the same way that like if you're building it somewhere, you're pushing someone else out. It's like the flip side of the coin of that very cutting phrase.
And to go to the final historical Indian removal that Sedgwick was sort of a part of, the Cherokee, the Trail of Tears, Sedgwick's got a relationship to that. Now, this starts initially because there was what was known as the Cornwall Foreign Mission School in Connecticut. This was start of the early 1800s. And Sedgwick's cousin, Harriet Gold, married a Cherokee there, Elias Boudinot. This was a year before Hope Leslie came out. And this was a somewhat controversial marriage. And because Boudinot was John Ridge's cousin, who was a Cherokee sort of leader or a political figure who was also at this mission school. And he also married the white daughter of one of the leaders of the school. And so there are these two interracial relationships that were very controversial at the time of the publication for Hope Leslie that she and Ridge was also Boudinot's cousin. So Boudinot was married to Sedgwick's cousin and his cousin was also the Cherokee Ridge. Both of those guys would eventually be down in Georgia, where they would sign the treaty for the Trail of Tears. They were part of the Native Americans that were like, this is the best we're going to get. We just need to sign it and get out. They're later assassinated because they had signed it by Cherokees, upset that they had signed that paper. And that's maybe the darkest of the three related, and maybe the most amazing in mm-hmm. a small world sense, that, you know, the Trail of Tears, I don't think that phrase has weakened in the almost 200 years that it's been in the United States.
Yeah, we've come across a number of moments in early American history and a lot of contemporary, like, disasters, and contemporary tellings of it always refrain with like, I don't know how America's ever going to get over this. And they usually find ways to, you know, ignore it or bury it or something like that. But then there's one every once in a while that leaves like such a psychic scar, like the Trail of Tears, that it gives you an instantaneous emotional reaction, even now.
And Donald Trump has Andrew Jackson's picture in the Oval Office.
Mm. It's like his one correct like step into history. Like, he's absolutely right to place himself next to it. He's so yes. right that he mustn't know how right he is. I mean, someone must just to, like, have told him.
Yeah, Bannon.
Oh, right.
Basically. So I think that's enough for the biographical background for Sedgwick. But very complex background, racially speaking and culturally speaking, for her. That, you know, actually, I want to read one more thing. It's her talking about Eunice. So we can get an idea of how she actually felt about this cousin of hers that stayed with the Native Americans. Life and Letters of Catherine Maria Sedgwick. This is a collection of her. It doesn't say exactly who this is written to here. But in the summer of 1821, Sedgwick traveled to upstate New York and Canada, and in the travel journal she kept for her friends at home, she expresses her disappointment that she was not able to visit the clergyman at Oneida who ministered to the spiritual interests of the poor natives. The clergyman was Eliezer Williams, Eunice's great-grandson, a faraway cousin of ours. While claiming her mixed-blood cousin, however, Sedgwick feels compelled to overlay the relation with mystical significance. Here's Sedgwick writing, "Do not be startled, my dear girls, though some Indian blood is mingled in his veins with a fairer current. He is descended from a daughter of a Parson Williams of Deerfield. She was taken by the savages during one of their incursions into the newly formed settlement of our pious ancestors. She was so young that she soon lost all recollection of her parents. Many years after, when peace was established with our wild neighbors, but not till after the bear's teeth and claws had been taken out." I don't know what that means. Like they've been tamed?
Maybe.
I think that's what it means. It is a weird way to put it. Her friends made a fruitless effort to recover her. She had married an Indian and chosen his country for her country and his God for her God. And like the tender and true-hearted Ruth, she has been the mother of a servant of the Lord. Mr. Williams, for he bears the name of his maternal ancestor, is said to labor with great zeal and some success among the remnant of his tribe. Which is a bit, like, that's another thing, is Eunice Williams has a grandson who's trying to Christianize the Native Americans, right? Mm-hmm. Like, it's sort of... There's this book. Have you heard about this book, The Killing of the Flower Moon?
No.
I'm going to read the bio up here.
Making stuff up?
No. Yeah. The Osage Murders and the Birth of the FBI. Basically, there was a reservation in Oklahoma, I believe, that was very rich in oil wealth. So the Osage Indians that were there were like these millionaire Indians, and then I think
that's the end of the story
and they lived happily ever after.
Something that worked out.
Literally I think some white people tried to marry in / genocided them and took all the money for themselves,
the old Habsburg approach.
So yeah, it's pretty gruesome. I think that sort of gives enough of biographical detail about the author. Let's move on to the story, shall we, guys? First, let's go chapter 4-7. That's the next part. We're up here. Last time we left off, Mrs. Fletcher was writing to Mr. Fletcher saying that the help was playing a bit too much cards, and there were some Indians that were looking menacing around the perimeter of the village. And so Digby, and we come to chapter four here, Digby and Everil, Digby the manservant of the house, who's a Pequot War veteran, and Everil basically sit up in as a guard overnight, and they notice, and they talk about Magawiska here. Digby's telling him some war stories, and Everil's excited by to hear him, basically. And now they're talking about how good Everil would be in a fight situation. A boy's courage is a keen weapon that wants temper. Apt to break at the first stroke from the enemy, you mean, Digby? Digby nodded assent. Well, I should like, at any rate, to prove it, added Everil. Time enough this half dozen years yet, my young master. I should be loath to see that fair skin of thine stained with blood, and, besides, you have yet to get a little more worldly prudence than to trust a young Indian girl just because she takes your fancy. And why does she take my fancy, Digby? Because she is true and noble-minded. I am certain that if she knows of any danger approaching us, she is seeking to avert it. I don't know that, Mr. Everil. She'll be first true to her own people. The old proverb holds fast with these savages, as well as with the rest of the world. Hawks won't pick out hawk's eyes. Like to like, throughout all nature. I grant you, she hath truly a fair seeming. I always thought that hawks won't pick out hawk's eyes line is such a, like, that is... It's really, it's weird how it's always dehumanization that these conversations always go, right? Like, well, we're not a hawks and she's a hawk. So she's protected among the hawks. Like, it's just, and I mean, I guess Digby in this, well, I guess we won't, well, I'm not going to say anything more. And all that's foul is our own suspicion, is it not, Digby? Not exactly. There's plainly some mystery between Magawiska and the old woman, and we know these Pequods were famed above all Indian tribes for their cunning. And what is superior cunning among savages but superior sense? You may outtalk me, Mr. Everil, replied Digby, with the impatience that a man feels when he is sure he is right, without being able to make it appear.
Extremely relatable.
That's pretty common, because that happened in, remember, The Spy? I can't remember which of the characters is being like, they're talking about how Britain doesn't have slavery and America does.
Oh, yeah.
And he's like, well, you know, that's a strong argument. I'm pretty sure there's an answer to it, though.
Yeah,
just going to move on with my life.
Yeah.
And this will actually also happen in later again in Hope Leslie here.
Well, I think it's that it shows the work and care that the colonial project needs. Like, every single day you have to be able to, like, uphold this idea of superiority, and you're like, it's like a civilizing mission, and these people are cunning and dangerous and hawks, and we're not, even though it's projection
and
all the way through.
And Cedric in the preface already pointed us to the way the adjectives are deployed. Basically, they're saying more about the people using the words than they are the people that the words are used to describe. You may outtalk me, but you will never convince me. Was not I in the Pequod War? I ought to know, I think. Yes, and I think you have told me they showed more resolution than cunning there, in particular that the brother of Magawiska, whom she so piteously bemoans to this day, fought like a young lion. Yes, he did, poor dog, and he was afterwards cruelly cut off, and it is this that makes me think they will take some terrible revenge for his death. I often hear Magawiska talking to Oniko of her brother, and I think it is to stir his spirit. But this boy is no more like him than a spaniel to a bloodhound. Nothing Digby said had any tendency to weaken Everil's confidence in Magawiska. The subject of the Pequod War once started, Digby and Everil were in no danger of sleeping at their post. Digby loved as well as another man, and particularly those who have had brief military experience, to fight his battles over again. And Everill was at an age to listen with delight to tales of adventure and danger. They thus wore away the time till the imagination of both relator and listener were at that pitch when every shadow is embodied, and every passing sound bears a voice to the quickened sense. As they're out on this vigil, they see Magawiska, the Pequot girl, sneak out of her lodgings and go visit Nalima, who's another Indian woman who's accused and of being a witch, basically. They don't trust her. And Digby sees that and sends Everill to go ask Magawiska what's going on. After a little while, either exhausted by the violence of her emotion or comforted by Everill... Oh, and so Everill goes up and tries to talk to her, but Everill is a bit soft, I guess we should say. And he doesn't want to accuse Magawiska of any kind of duplicity. And so when she appears disconcerted to see him, he is apologetic and tries to comfort her, and that's where we pick up here. After a little while, either exhausted by the violence of her emotion or comforted by Everill's silent sympathy, she became composed and raised her face from her mantle, and as she did so, something fell from beneath its fold. She hastily recovered and replaced it, but not till Everill had perceived it was an eagle's feather. He knew this was the badge of her tribe, and he heard her say that a tuft from the wing of the monarch bird was her father's crest. A suspicion flashed through his mind and was conveyed to Magawiska's by one bright glance of inquiry. She said nothing, but her responding look was rather sorrowful than confused, and Everill, anxious to believe what he wished to be true, came, after a little consideration, to the conclusion that the feather had been dropped in her path by a passing bird. He did not scrutinize her motive in concealing it. He could not think her capable of evil, and anxious to efface from her mind the distrust his countenance might have expressed, "This beautiful moon and her train of stars," he said. Okay, we can stop briefly there. That's I didn't really notice this, but there's symmetry to what Cedric's doing with Everill and Digby, who are getting their interpretation of reality morphed and disturbed by fear and suspicion. And then later he's with Magawiska, and Everill's interpretation of reality is being distorted by the opposite of that, which I think is an interesting psychological comment for Cedric to make there.
Yeah, I like the psychology of showing two characters at odds on a given opinion, like Digby and Everill, and watching their internal, like their minds at work, and how really nothing is coming through even remotely, like from the other side. They're just reasoning or rationalizing to like buttress their previously held opinions, which I think is very, very accurate for how people actually are.
Yep.
And then even when like Everill gets a confirmation that Digby is correct in at some level about Magawiska, he's like, well, I've got to believe something else, and quickly grabs that and then puts that in, and it just becomes true. I don't know. I think that's just very, that's very close to reality.
Yeah. Turns out people like to believe it's not even just what they like to believe. I like to put it as what's most hospitable to how they view their social reality. You generally don't want to believe things that make that less comfortable for you, and how things are made less comfortable is going to be different if you're a kid who has a crush on the new domestic servant versus if you're a veteran of the Pequot War and you might have like set hundreds of people on fire.
But I think it's interesting that throughout the book she seems to be on the side of the youthful, intuitive, romantic response to the world. Mm-hmm. Like, her sympathies are very clearly with Hope and Everall and the way they respond to each other. And here it's interesting that she's actually showing the fallibility of youth mm-hmm. in Everall's kind of messy response here. And right. that seems very savvy of her psychologically.
Now we'll play a little bit further in how Everall tries to fact find here. "This beautiful moon and her train of stars," he said, "look as if they were keeping their watch over our dwelling. There are those, Magawiska, who believe the stars have a mysterious influence on human destiny. I know nothing of the grounds of their faith, and my imagination is none of the brightest. But I can almost fancy they are stationed there as guardian angels, and I feel quite sure that nothing evil could walk abroad in their light." "They do look peaceful," she replied mournfully.
So I just think there's something very funny about a guy trying to use astrology to chat up a woman.
Who among us?
It's kind of cute. I mean, it sounds like he's just trying so hard to talk to her in her language or mm-hmm. what he thinks her language is.
Right.
He's like trying to invoke the Great Spirit and kind of failing miserably, but... Yeah.
And he has just so much less like life experience than right. Magawiska that it's like, yeah, I mean, it'd be nice to just like the way this stuff feels, but...
"They do look peaceful," she replied mournfully. "But ah, Everall, man is ever breaking the peace of nature. It was such a night as this, so bright and still, when your English came upon our quiet homes. You have never spoken to me of that night, Magawiska." "No, Everall, for our hands have taken hold of the chain of friendship, and I feared to break it by speaking of the wrongs your people laid on mine." "You need not fear it. I can honor noble deeds, though done by our enemies, and see that cruelty is cruelty, though inflicted by our friends. Then listen to me, and when the hour of vengeance comes, if it should come, remember it was provoked."
I mean, so far in our readings, that's the best summation of the American experience that we've come across.
Right.
That someone is willing, there are people coming from two radically different backgrounds and radically different levels of exploitation. And one, they're trying to get along in a society, and they say, to get along, we can't essentially talk about all the injustices that got to this exact moment. And then there's like the good-hearted liberal or whatever, someone who's like, no, I'm willing to look into the book of the past and hear what's happened, even if these people are my kin, or even if I'm like, I've gotten certain ill-gotten gains because of this exploitation.
Mm-hmm.
And then what Magawiska is saying is that the past isn't even over, that it's coming for you, basically. Yeah. And it just, even if you feel like you didn't do it, you did do it, like in a communal sense. I think that's the breakdown and the mistake that seems to always happen in that conversation, even today.
Yeah. This is why people are so sensitive when you say something like chickens coming home to roost about,
yeah.
Like, say, yeah, blowback about how America has been propping up monarchies across the world for basically oil. definitely. We heard Digby talk about Samoset, Magawiska's brother, and how he died. Later on, after there's a fairly long section of Magawiska explaining the massacre to Everall, we get to this part where she tells him about how Samoset perished.
"You did not tell me, Magawiska," said Everall, "how Samoset perished. Was he consumed in the flames or shot from the palisade?" "Neither, neither. He was reserved to whet my father's revenge to a still keener edge. He had forced a passage through the English, and hastily collecting a few warriors, they pursued the enemy, sprung upon them from a covert, and did so annoy them that the English turned and gave them battle. All fled save my brother, and him they took prisoner. They told him they would spare his life if he would guide them to our strongholds. He refused. He had Everall, lived but 16 summers. He loved the light of the sun even as we love it. His manly spirit was tamed by wounds and weariness. His limbs were like a bending reed, and his heart beat like a woman's. But the fire of his soul burnt clear. Again they pressed him with offers of life and reward. He faithfully refused, and with one saber stroke they severed his head from his body. Megawiska paused. She looked at Everil and said with a bitter smile, "You English tell us, Everil, that the book of your law is better than that written on our hearts. For ye say it teaches mercy, compassion, forgiveness. If ye had such a law and believed it, would ye thus have treated a captive boy?" Megawiska's reflecting mind suggested the most serious obstacle to the progress of the Christian religion in all ages and under all circumstances, the contrariety between its divine principles and the conduct of its professors, which, instead of always being a medium for the light that emanates from our holy law, is too often the darkest cloud that obstructs the passage of its rays to the hearts of heathen men. Everil had been carefully instructed in the principles of his religion, and he felt Megawiska's relation to be an awkward comment on them, and her inquiry natural. But though he knew not what answer to make, he was sure there must be a good one, and mentally resolving to refer the case to his mother, he begged Megawiska to proceed with her narrative. Yeah, so there it is, right again in the same chapter. Yeah, I'm sure we're right. I'm sure there's some bit of detail that will prove us to be not as bad as we look here.
Yeah.
I just need to find it. And this is what every single second of conservative media exists to produce. It's that plausible deniability that, oh no, some people say removing pre-existing conditions would be good. Or for most people. Some people
say, well, that's just not true.
Yeah, exactly, right? You need to hear both sides.
Yeah.
You need to hear the side of the people who want people to have health care and the side of the people who think that's a waste of money.
Well, you see that argumentation with like woke imperial war, like under Obama, where it's like, this isn't Iraq, this is Libya, this is completely different. Like, we're not sending in ground troops, they're just going to have institutional slavery in 3 years. What's the big deal?
I think it is more of a conservative,
yeah, as far as talking points go. Yeah, but I think that ability to rationalize, which is like, I know there's an answer somewhere, I'm just being tripped up by this tricky person who's trying to make me look stupid.
Right. Well, what it is fundamentally is, I know there must be a reason for me to just continue on doing exactly what I'm doing.
Yeah.
And because if that reason didn't, like a climate change, for instance, right? Like that, every single bit of conservative messaging about climate change for the past like decade, at least more than two decades, has been relax a little bit. They're exaggerating it. Like it's not so bad. And this might all be okay.
Mm-hmm.
And just check out this study. See, this study says that the climate scientists are all like lying.
Yeah.
And like that impulse of human beings to look for a reason to just continue on as they were is, I think, one of the most insidious impulses people have.
I think here it's also gendered in that he responds to her very... her story, which has such moral force that is like unarguable, with this kind of weaselly intellectual, like, oh, I'm just gonna think about how I can come back to you later with some reason, yeah, you know, some flaw in your argument, when she's actually not really making an argument, she's just asserting like a moral truth,
right?
And yeah,
his response to that is very cowardly.
That's something that good art can do, which it can elucidate truth at its like most finest element, and watch, and that's what truth usually is. It's not hard to grasp, it's just hard to continue to live your life the way you do while still holding that truth in your mind. And so you watch people, and like myself included, walk away from truth all the time, not because it's hard to grasp, but because I can't deal with the consequences of that reality.
Mm-hmm. Well, and because, I mean, it's the social circle thing again. Like I think it's true, for instance, that the Republican Party represents fascism.
Right.
But that is not going to be, that's like getting there for people that have never read anything about fascism, that couldn't define it in any sort of loose terms other than like what Hitler did. That's just not a conversation you can really have, I guess. I'm not sure. Let's continue to where Cedric sort of summarizes what this experience of hearing about the Pequot War from Magawiska's perspective sort of meant for him. This war, so fatal to the Pequots, had transpired the preceding year. It was an important event to the infant colonies, and its magnitude probably somewhat heightened to the imaginations of the English by the terror this resolute tribe had inspired. All the circumstances attending it were still fresh in men's mind, and Everill had heard them detailed with the interest and particularity that belongs to recent adventures. But he had heard them in a language of the enemies and the conquerors of the Pequods, and from Magawiska's lips they took a new form and hue. She seemed to him to embody nature's best gifts, and her feelings to be the inspiration of heaven. This new version of an old story reminded him of the man and the lion in the fable. But here it was not merely changing sculptors to give the advantage to one or the other of the artist's subjects, but it was putting the chisel into the hands of truth and giving it to whom it belonged. He had heard this destruction of the original possessors of the soul described, as we find it in the history of the times, where, we are told, the number destroyed was about 400, and it was a fearful sight to see them thus frying in the fire, and the streams of blood quenching the same, and the horrible scent thereof, but the victory seemed a sweet sacrifice, and they gave the praise thereof to God. In the relations of their enemies, the courage of the Pequods was distorted into ferocity, and their fortitude, in their last extremity, thus set forth. Many were killed in the swamp, like sullen dogs, that would rather, in their self-willedness and madness, sit still to be shot or cut in pieces, than receive their lives for asking at the hands of those whose power they had now fallen. Everill's imagination, touched by the wand of feeling, presented a very different picture of those defenseless families of savages, pent in the recesses of their native forests, and there exterminated, not by a superior natural force, but by the adventurous circumstances of arms, skill, and knowledge, from that offered those who, then living and worthy of credit, did affirm that in the morning, entering into the swamp, they saw several heaps of them, the Pequods, sitting close together, upon whom they discharged their pieces, laden with 10 or 12 pistol bullets at a time, putting the muzzles of their pieces under the bows, within a few yards of them. Everill did not fail to express to Magawiska, with all the eloquence of a heated imagination, his sympathy and admiration of her heroic and suffering people. She listened with a mournful pleasure, as one listens to the praise of a departed friend. Regardless of how history ended up playing out in general, this sort of that storytelling can create sympathy that leads to progress in people is a fundamental belief that Cedric herself held at this point. Like, fiction is in its early throes, and that I can't find the citation here, but that is something she was conscious of, is what this art can actually do for society. So I think, like, it's one of my favorite scenes from a book that I've read for this project. And learning about the actual history behind it just makes that more and more so.
I think it's as her as a author that she's a very profound understanding of loss and tragedy and how to describe it, because she starts with the macro and then zooms in as tight as possible on like the family unit or the single person and describes that savagery. That's the only way to break through that noise as like if you're a reader, or if you're like getting information secondhand from it, is if it's like a village was demolished, your mind finds ways to make that just a statistic. Mm-hmm. But Sedgwick pushes right through that and makes you think about like the individual horror, and then slowly pulls out of that to the point where at least for me as a reader, at a certain point, I just have to shut off or I can't think about it. Like, well, I can't imagine that a massacre at that size.
And what's interesting about what Cedric dedicates space to is she summarizes what Digby tells Everil, but she explicitly and for pages and pages goes into what Digby tells Everil.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a political choice. That's a doing a both sides thing. And I think there's occasion where Cedric does throw fig leaves out to maybe the more apologetic to the pilgrims historians. And there's a few passages that I feel like read like that. But ultimately, what she dedicates space to, I think, shows her real politics.
And the fact that she puts Magawiska's account like side by side with the sources.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she quotes from William Bradford's History of Plymouth Plantation, and later I think Hubbard. The fact that they are like right next to each other in the book, it seems like very provocative. And to me, you know, I read this as Cedric in the mode of a historian as much as a fiction writer, and particularly making Magawiska the instrument of oral history and as a way of recovering this repressed narrative.
Yeah, yeah.
It's very bold.
And it's interesting, while you mention Hubbard, Hubbard comes up later in the second part, the second part we're going to talk about tonight, as one of the prospective suitors of Hope.
Yeah, the guy from Cambridge, right?
Yes, yeah.
Oh, yeah. And which she has this very wry aside. She's like, and thus did Hope Leslie avoid...
Yeah, she would have thought he was a square. So because of her peculiar taste, she missed out on the historian of New England.
She dodged a bullet.
That is a very interesting meta sort of textual or historical like little thing she does.
She could have married the Nate Silver of his time.
Like, it reminds me of, it's not quite as maybe indulgent as Martin Amis in one of his books has a character named Martin Amis that just clearly Martin Amis.
Revolutionary.
So Megawiska's given Everil that history, which is, I mean, Everil never pauses to say, like, hey, I came to figure out what you were saying about the threat our little house here is under, and you instead told me about something we did to you. He never quite puts those two things together. Mr. Fletcher's still in Boston with Hope Leslie. Faith and Onico are hanging out in Bethel, this new house that Mrs. Fletcher and Everil and Megawiska, they're all at. And Mr. Fletcher's returning, finally, with Hope Leslie. So everyone is sort of excited about this. The patriarch is coming back, and as we heard, even Mrs. Fletcher was becoming to get a little bit disquieted by his absence. And it turns out that only Magawiska is feeling a bit conflicted about the return, and we pick up here with a scene of sort of matrimonial utopia. A mother encircled by healthful, sporting children is always a beautiful spectacle, a spectacle that appeals to nature in every human breast. Mrs. Fletcher, in obedience to matrimonial duty, or, it may be, from some lingering of female vanity, had, on this occasion, attired herself with extraordinary care. What woman does not wish to look handsome in the eyes of her husband? Mother, said Everil, putting aside the exquisitely fine lace that shaded her cheek. I do not believe you looked more beautiful than you do today when, as I have heard, they called you the Rose of the Wilderness. Our little Mary's cheek is as round and as bright as a peach, but it is not so handsome as yours, mother. Your heart has sent this color here, he continued, kissing it tenderly. It seems to have come forth to tell us that our father is near. It would shame me, Everil, replied his mother, embracing him with a feeling that the proudest drawing-room belle might have envied, to take such a flattery from any lips but thine. Oh, do not call it flattery, mother. Look, Megawiska, for heaven's sake, cheer up. Look, would you know mother's eye?
It's a horror story.
Just turn it, mother. 1 minute from that road, and her pale cheek too, with this rich color on it. Alas, alas, replied Megawiska, glancing her eye at Mrs. Fletcher, and then, as if heartstruck, withdrawing them. How soon the flush of the setting sun fades from the evening cloud. Oh, Magawiska, said Evril impatiently, why are you so dismal? Your voice is too sweet for a bird of ill omen. I shall begin to think as Jennet says, though Jennet is no textbook for me. I shall begin to think old Nalima has really bewitched you. You call me a bird of ill omen, replied Magawiska, half proud, half sorrowful. And you can call the owl a bird of ill omen. But we hold him sacred. He is our sentinel. And when danger is near, he cries, awake, awake. Magawiska, you are positively unkind. Jeremiah's lamentations on a holiday would not be more out of time than your croaking is now.
God.
The very skies, earth, and air seem to partake our joy at father's return. And you only make a discord. Do you think if your father was near, I would not share your joy?
I mean, what the hell with that last part?
I hadn't realized how violent this section is.
Yeah.
Rhetorically, at least.
Yeah. Like, come on. You're ruining the fun.
Party pooper.
Yeah. Megawiska's being a party pooper. That line about, you don't think I'd be happy if your father...
That's tone deaf.
Yeah.
So, I mean, also, it's got some nice, like... dramatic irony to it. It's like, my dad is coming.
Yeah, I mean, if you only knew how true that was.
Yeah.
How old is he at this point, Everall? Is he like 16-year-old?
I feel like, yeah, it was like 14 or something.
He's still pretty young because he hasn't gone to the UK for education yet.
He's in his late teens when he comes back.
Yeah, so he's in early teens, I think, at this point.
I mean, how much can we expect from him?
Yeah.
A lot. Yeah. I think that
as far as his sensitivities go, I think he's pretty par for the course as far as teenage boys go.
He's basically on he's like on Fortnite right now.
Yeah. Oh God.
She highlights frequently that Magawiska can hold two different emotions in her head at the same time in a way that no one in that house can do. Like, we're happy now, why aren't we happy? And Magawiska's like, I'm actually happy and sad at the same time. And they're like, what the hell does that even mean?
Later, I think she actually connects that to Shakespeare.
Mm-hmm.
Like, she talks about how Shakespeare has these dramas in which there are these extremes of emotion and characters can oscillate between emotions at incredible rates.
That's in Hope Leslie's letter to Evril, I believe, when he's in studying.
And this is one of the things that Hope and Magawiska share, I think, an ability to be ambivalent, to hold two things in their mind at once, and kind of like move in and out of emotional states very quickly.
Yeah, to respond to the surroundings more appropriately rather than like try to make the world submit to your will. Like, I'm happy, so this place is happy, and only happy things are going to happen.
It's because God wants it, and like, look at nature, how beautiful nature is.
Yeah, and it's linked to a purity of conscience as well. Wow.
Yeah, and a connection to the earth, I feel like, that it's like...
organic.
My heartbeat is like in tune with like the rhythm of the earth. I don't know.
Yeah, it posits
truth. No, I don't know. This is stupid.
Yeah, Alex, can you leave, please?
God.
We're about to come up on another entertainment from centuries ago. Let's see if
you need another sound effect for that.
Yeah, let's see if you guys can pick up on it here. Tears fell from Magawiska's eye, but she made no reply. And Mrs. Fletcher, observing and compassionating her emotions, and thinking it probably arose from comparing her orphan state to that of the merry children about her, called her and said, Magawiska, you are neither a stranger nor a servant. Will you not share our joy? Do you not love us? Love you, she exclaimed, clasping her hands. Love you, I would give my life for you. We do not ask your life, my good girl, replied Mrs. Fletcher, kindly smiling on her, but a light heart and cheerful look. A sad countenance doth not become this joyful hour. Go and help Onico. He is quite out of breath, blowing those soap bubbles for the children. Onico smiled and shook his head. He continued to send off one after another of the prismatic globes.
So yeah, bubbles. Blowing bubbles.
That's a thing you could do if you're bored. We always talk about, like, yeah, the past would be interesting from a curiosity standpoint to visit, but it'd be so boring. Well, Get some bubbles out, buddy.
Yeah, true.
Get some bubbles, some cards.
That's like the avatar of its time.
We need to make a compendium of different sort of fun activities you could do.
Rocking chair.
Rocking chair is the most famous.
That's a pretty good one. That's like the proto roller coaster. So we've got soap bubbles, rocking chairs, and cards.
Talking about the brutal past.
Yeah, war stories.
But cards is debauched, right? Wasn't that...
That's true. Cards is debauched.
Yeah, that's like
we want to divide the innocent pleasures.
Okay, yeah, the vices. Yeah,
the hardcore pornography of this time.
Yeah, exactly. Onico smiled and shook his head. He continued to send off one after another of the prismatic globes. And as they rose and floated on the air and brightened with the many-colored ray, the little girls clapped their hands, and the baby stretched his to grasp the brilliant vapor. "Oh," said Magawiska, impetuously covering her eyes, "I do not like to see anything so beautiful pass so quickly away." Scarcely had she uttered these words, when suddenly, as if the earth had opened on them, three Indian warriors darted from the forest and pealed on the air their horrible yells. And we'll cut it there. Yeah.
In your notes, didn't you have something about this being like a multicultural utopia?
Yeah, that's sort of how I started this clip with the old, this was a mother surrounded by children and, you know, like even the adoptive Pequod children are, you know, blowing mm-hmm. bubbles and entertaining the kids and that sort of thing.
And it's like a moment of intense, like, excitement. Like, it's only, their day is only about to get better.
They're having so much fun that they're annoyed by the person who's not having fun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's so fleeting.
Yes. Yeah. And I think almost maybe the bubble imagery is a play on that. Like, mm-hmm. it's look at how beautiful and sparkling it is, and then it's gone.
Yeah. Yep. You don't know, how quick it will be ripped from you.
It's like, this is in sepia tone.
Mm. Yeah.
The scene.
Yeah.
So, basically, I don't know how much we want to summarize for what happens with the attack there. It is, indeed, Magawiska's father. And,
I guess... not happy about it, actually.
He was, it turns out, had a bit of a bone to pick with Mrs. Fletcher. She died. Also, that baby who was reaching for that bubble was also killed. And then Averill... Faith, and Onico and Magawiska are all taken with Mononato, Magawiska's father, and that's the sort of the remainder of chapter six.
I love how the chapter closes with the casting off of the colonizer's outfit when. Mm. As they passed the boundary of cleared ground, Mononato tore from Onico the English dress, casting it from him. "Thus perish," he said, "every mark of the captivity of my children. Thou shalt return to our forest."
Yeah.
He continued wrapping a skin around him with a badge of thy people.
Yeah, good find, especially considering what we talked about with clothing last time.
Yeah, clothing is very salient in this book with like Grafton, Mrs. Grafton and her kind of love of fine lace and all of the things that the Puritans are not so keen on.
We should point out the reason Digby was not at the home to guard it was because Aunt Grafton sent him
on an errand
to go get to pick up the fashion items that Grafton had shipped over from London.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. That actually sets us up rather nicely for the next clip. Which is, we're going to zoom all the way forward to chapter 8. And this is an epistolary chapter.
Ooh, learning from the last episode.
Yeah, exactly. chapter 8, there's a bit of a... actually, I'm going to go back. I'm going to go to our good old summary. So we'll just summarize what we sort of talked about here and then where we're going. This is from... Michael Davitt Bell, who we cited last week. While Fletcher Sr. and Hope Leslie are still in Boston, the Indian chief Mononado attacks to redeem his captive children. Everil and Faith are captured while Mrs. Fletcher and her other children are killed. The captives are taken to an Indian village where Everil is sentenced to be beheaded. As Mononado brings down the axe, however, Magawiska interposes his arm between the falling blade and Everil's neck. Although she loses her arm in the process, Magawiska does enable Everil to escape and return to the remnant of his family in Springfield. Faith Leslie remains in captivity and eventually marries the Indian youth Oniko, just like Eunice Williams did. So Oniko gets away. The story is resumed in 1645, 9 years later, by means of a letter from Hope Leslie, who is in Springfield with Mr. Fletcher and her aunt Grafton. The letter is addressed to Everil, who is being educated in England. Hope tells how when her tutor was saved, and we will not go any further there. Well, actually, we can go a little bit further. Was saved from a snake bite poisoning by an old Indian woman who was accused for her trouble of witchcraft. And that's Nalima, who we've already referred to. Now, this snake bite that Craddock suffered comes onto an excursion to Northampton that Hope joins. And she's warned against doing so by Aunt Grafton. And here's a little bit of that. It sort of comes into what like American womanhood and young womanhood is.
We are going tomorrow on an excursion to the new settlement on the river called Northampton. Your father feared the toils and perils of the way for me and has consented reluctantly to my being of the party. Aunt Grafton remonstrated and expressed her natural and kind apprehensions by alleging that it was very unladylike and a thing quite unheard of in England for a young person like me to go out exploring a new country. I urged that our new country develops faculties that young ladies in England were unconscious of possessing. She maintained, as usual, that whatever was not practiced and known in England was not worth possessing. But finally, she concluded her opposition with her old customary phrase, "Well, it's peculiar of you, Miss Hope," which, you know, she always uses to characterize whatever opposes her opinions or inclinations.
It's just you do you.
But
or like, bless your heart, which is like, I don't get this.
So. Well, there's also an appeal to a wider authority, right? Like, when you say something that's peculiar, it's not just like that. You're not really saying, especially someone who's so attuned to fashion, isn't just saying, that's in my opinion peculiar. It's that's peculiar to everybody, basically. And that it shows, I mean, it's interesting that, and Grafton's an interesting case because there's an extended portion where it talks about, why is this woman in America? Why did she decide to make that shift? And it basically because she had familial duty, but she still has a lot of these sort of, I guess, I don't know, what would you say, Anglophone tastes maybe at this time?
Is there anything else I wanted to say? I think she enjoys being the odd one out as well. She kind of enjoys being a little bit against the grain in the Puritan society.
Yeah, yeah. We'll go a bit about that, but she's definitely not religiously the same.
Are we going to talk about this idea of the American woman and the sort of different norms that are applying?
Yeah, well, it's interesting because what that section made me think of was in The Spy, one of the female characters, it's like when she leaves the house, it's sort of like, oh, what are you doing out here? And it's almost, and Sedgwick, obviously, she references Fenimore Cooper. She would have read every word that he published. It's a nice, this story is a nice rejoinder for what those stories miss, especially with regards to female characters.
Yeah.
And what they can be capable of.
Yeah. And I think it also goes to this idea that Hope's and Magawiska's, cause they're kind of doubled in this novel, their identification with nature is so strong that it's almost like they can't do anything but leave the house and explore. Like it's their instinct and it's their nature, and they are very much in tune with that.
I found it hard occasionally, like they sort of occupy the same part of my brain in terms of like the space I'm making for characters of this book, Hope and Magawiska.
I think that's by design.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Like, but it's so much so that it's like, it's unless I think about it, it's hard. They sort of meld together almost.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've put, we haven't gotten to her yet, but,
Esther.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh my God. Esther.
Esther, Hope, Leslie, and Magawiska are, they like illuminate each other and cast shadows on each other with all their actions, with how women move in society.
Mm.
Right. Now, this is when Hope is out on this excursion to Northampton. A number of articles mention Hope being a sort of precursor for the Transcendentalists, the way she talks about nature. And I feel like this part might have some of that.
Last week, the woods were as green as an emerald, and now they look as if all the summer spirits had been wreathing them with flowers of the richest and most brilliant dyes. Philosophers may inquire into the process of nature, and find out, if they can, how such changes are produced, though, after all, I fancy their inquiries will turn out like the experiment of the inquisitive boy who cut open the drum to find the sound.
I love that a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if she came up with that, or if that's like sort of an around, like that sort of, like,
was that example. Proverbial? Or?
Yeah, that's what I'm wondering.
Yeah, it has like a time-told adage quality to it. It's yeah, so
the boy perfect. Who cut open the drum to find the sound is. I mean, that is a great. I mean, man, I don't know what to really apply that to, but I find that
It's like a much more poetic way of like what is it, losing the forest from the trees or whatever it is.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
She's also like pushing back against the Enlightenment principles that she herself has espoused in the preface when she talks about conditions and all of that kind of like materialism that she's so attuned to.
Yeah.
It's an amazing contradiction.
Later on, she'll mention phrenology.
Mm.
Yes.
And in a way that like, at first I was like, what the hell's going on? But I think she's actually skeptical of it. She's like, well, they haven't mastered the arts of phrenology, so we'll just have to determine this by the slow process of character development or that sort of thing, right? Or behavior or something like that.
And yet, on the other hand, she seems to be very interested in how people's outward appearance does illuminate some aspect of their inner life. Mm. Like, I think the epithet she uses with Gardiner, he's like always, his complexion is ruddy.
Right.
And we're to assume, knowing what we know about him, that there's some connection between his ruddiness or his dark hair, his dark features, and his corrupt soul.
Right.
If that's not too much of a spoiler.
Yeah.
And like the bodies of Everil and Magawiska, on the other hand, they're like, they're sort of agile and hearty and healthy and glowing.
Megawiska's described, I believe, earlier as being like courtly almost, even for a Native American or something like that.
She has a noble appearance.
Yes, and yes, exactly. Yeah.
Different point though, but yeah, you can see the transcendentalism happening in real time. You can it's like you can see the synthesis at play between the Enlightenment and Romanticism coming over from England primarily at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And her way of connecting with Romanticism by entering into like America's massive deposits of forests and things like that is exactly what Emerson and Thoreau are going to touch on in
about 30 years time.
Yeah.
And it's so obvious to me that the reality of the American environment is what caused both of those things, or what caused transcendentalism, and also what I think, you know, the way Everil's trying to talk about the stars trying to talk to a Native American, right? Like, they're more grounded in the natural world, right?
Mm.
But that's just because, I don't think that's intrinsic to either the Transcendentalist or the Native American, that they just had that, right? Like, as opposed to even, like, Europe or China or something, it seems like you're more in a society. Maybe this is just a gross exaggeration, but the difference being like there's a boundless land that you can just go over, and not different societies to push up against.
Well, I think that turn towards nature is inherent in Romanticism, particularly with like the Lake School, like Coleridge or something.
Oh yeah.
And so for that then to come over to America, it would make sense for it to inherently just catch fire with like the intelligentsia of like, oh, we have tons of that shit over here.
Yeah. Okay, yeah.
Mm, it becomes a kind of source of cultural capital as well for them, I think.
For who?
For the transcendentalists.
Oh, yeah. Well, especially for Emerson. Oh, now we're getting off. But Emerson's like whole thing of like, we don't need cathedrals. We have right. natural cathedrals.
Right.
So you can see the cultural play he's making right here. It's like, we're actually already like established in the world because look at this huge sequoia tree.
Yep.
Yeah. So on that excursion, basically, Craddock, her tutor, gets bit by a rattlesnake. And in order to save him, and we're gonna gloss over this part, but it's worth reading. Magawiska brings him into the care of Nalima, who's been cited as the witch, Native American, and Nalima fixes him, but unfortunately, that fucking Jeanette is looking through the keyhole. And she's like,
"Why
how dare you
so big back
how
then?
Dare you do that satanic shit under this roof? I'm gonna go snitch. She called the cops. What would be the you know how when all, like white people called the cops on black people over like, you know, cutting a line?
Yeah, you're like parking in a slower than normal way.
Or like walking too fast. Mm-hmm. They always get a nickname. What would Jeanette's be?
Let's
see if we can
Jittery
describe,
Jeanette.
Like, Jittery Jeanette's not a bad one. Yeah. I think we'll have to keep it with Jittery Jeanette. So Jittery Jeanette goes and narcs on Nalima, and basically gets her locked up. Let's see. Am I skipping too far ahead? I don't want to summarize too much.
It almost feels heavy-handed, this. Like, the fact that she saves a man's life.
Mm-hmm.
And is then
sentenced to like death.
Sentenced to death for it. Like, it's almost like Sedgwick is getting a bit out of control with her symbolism.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. And Hope testifies to the magistrates. The magistrates are like, "You're a young girl. Why are we even listening
to
you?"
Yeah, I think he says that it's like the whistling of a bird.
Yes, yeah. This is one of the first times she's patronized as like a small bird or something like this. But luckily, her and Digby, notably, break Nalima free. And that's described in chapter 9.
But you only find out about it after the fact, which is kind of cool.
Yeah. So basically, you have in chapter 8, you have Hope writing to Everil to try to describe what's been happening, but she pulls the punches a bit because she doesn't want, I guess, to admit fully that she's the one who busted
Makawiska free. She doesn't want to put it in writing.
Yeah. And so chapter 9 is Sedgwick saying, this is what actually, we'll fill in some of the blanks here.
Slight aside is I can't emphasize enough reading this novel how much whiplash you get going from chapter to chapter.
Totally.
In style, tone, form, and the way the information is presented. It's just like, now we're at this, like, we're with this Native American tribe. Now we're back home, like, and the home's fine. Actually, the home's gone. Now it's epistolary. And it's just, it makes for great reading, especially when you're in, like, the hands of what I think is, like, a very... confident and good writer, but good lord, like going from like every time you finish a chapter, like, where am I going?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No. And the debriefs in the chapters following, like, she does this exact same thing a few chapters later with Hope's excursion to the cemetery, where it happens and you don't quite know what's going on, and then the chapter later you get the explanation.
Yeah, it's like, about that, this is what happened.
Right.
It's definitely meant to be like an all-encompassing novel for the reader. Like, you shouldn't be doing anything else.
Yeah, and I do find it interesting that we go into this super, to the point where we're reading their letters, a character-based format. And then, Cedric comes in with her own comments, and I believe this is one of those. This is in chapter 9, and this is on Hope's character and how she sort of developed into how she developed. And I think we get a bit of Grafton's sort of heterodox religious opinions as well. It may appear improbable that a girl of 17, educated among the strictest sect of the Puritans, should have had the open, fearless, and gay character of Hope Leslie. But it must be remembered that she lived in an atmosphere of favor and indulgence which permits the natural qualities to shoot forth in unrepressed luxuriance, an atmosphere of love that, like the tropical climate, brings forth the richest flowers and most flavorous fruits. She was transferred from the care of the gentlest and tenderest of mothers to Mr. Fletcher, who, though stern in his principles, was indulgent in his practice,
whose denying virtues were all self-denying, and who infused into the parental affection he felt for the daughter something of the romantic tenderness of the lover of her mother. Her aunt Grafton doted on her. She was the depository of her vanity, as well as of her affections. To her simple tutor, she seemed to embody all that philosophers and poets had set down in their books of virtue and beauty, and those of the old and rigid, who were above or below the influence of less substantial charms, regarded the young heiress with deference. In short, she was the petted lamb of the fold. It has been seen that Hope Leslie was superior to some of the prejudices of the age. This may be explained without attributing too much to her natural sagacity. Those persons she loved most, and with whom she had lived through her infancy, were of variant religious sentiments. Her father had belonged to the established church, and though he had much of the gay spirit that characterized the Cavaliers of the day, he was serious and exact in his observance of the rites of the church. She had often been her mother's companion at the prescribed meeting, and witnessed the fervor with which she joined in the worship of a persecuted and suffering people. Early impressions sometimes form molds for subsequent opinions. And when at a more reflective age, Hope heard her aunt Grafton rail with a natural good sense, and with the freedom, if not the point, of mother wit, at some of the peculiarities of the Puritans, she was led to doubt their infallibility, and like the bird that spreads his wings and soars above the limits by which each man fences in his own narrow domain, she enjoyed the capacities of her nature and permitted her mind to expand beyond the contracted boundaries of sectarian faith. Her religion was pure and disinterested. No one, therefore, should doubt its intrinsic value, though it had not been coined into a particular form or received the current impress. Though the history of our heroine, like a treasured flower, has only left its sweetness on the manuscript page from which we have amplified it, yet we have been compelled to infer, from some transactions which we shall faithfully record, that she had faults. But we leave our readers to discover them. Who has the resolution to point out a favorite's defects?
There's a lot going on there. It's like a manifesto for liberal democracy.
Yeah, I mean, I really appreciate anybody at this point in time, 1827, saying this wasn't nature or this woman's like biology. It was the conditions that she was raised in that allowed her to flourish like this, which is a story that we need to not stop telling today. Right.
Yeah, it's almost like if anyone is raised in an atmosphere of love, they can attain this level of like moral insight and virtue.
Yeah, this moment feels like maybe Sedgwick channeling Shakespeare most explicitly or most thematically, maybe, because especially in those later plays like Hamlet or Antony and Cleopatra, these characters that had the ability to oscillate radically in emotions, like you were saying earlier, but you get this feeling that all of them are acting with this greater sense of something beyond the material world in front of them. Like there's a divinity that shapes our ends. Like Magawiska is the like living embodiment of that concept, that even though she's living in a world of like a material world of struggle and pain and defeat, she's grasping towards reconciliation on some level and moving towards like a more ultimate goal that could be like liberal democracy or like the kingdom of heaven or something like that, that she's moving towards something much bigger than herself, that is her European Christian neighbors are impeding her from and impeding themselves from.
I want to read a few paragraphs from Patricia Larson Kalagian, who we cited last week from California State University, Revisioning America's Literary Past, Sedgwick's Hope Leslie. Kalagian writes, "Sedgwick's multivocal play with the essentializing idea of female submissiveness illustrates one way in which she disputes the culturally advocated behavior of women, subverting through action or implication precisely that which her rhetoric appears to endorse.
consider the result of Mrs. Fletcher's marital submission. Mrs. Fletcher feeling, as this is quoting, Mrs. Fletcher feeling, as good wives do, a sense of safety from the proximity of her husband, bade Digby defer any new arrangement for the family's protection, till he had the benefit of his master's counsel. Here she is outwardly admired for her submission to her husband, but when Mrs. Fletcher... But when Mrs. Fletcher prematurely relaxes from her role as primary protector into the inferior position of dependent wife, she and her children are massacred. Yeah. Mrs. Winthrop is also presented as a perfect example of a Puritan wife, and we'll have an example of this soon, who recognizes the duty of unqualified obedience from the wife to the husband. Like a horse easy on the bit, she was guided by the slightest intimation from him who held the rein. It was there's a I think it's New Young Pony Club that have like a shiny boots of leather. It's like a BDSM song. That's what.
Oh, Velvet Underground.
Is it Velvet Underground?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, and Nico. Yeah. take the bit.
Like, I just erased Nico in history. The one woman in the band. Like, yeah, it was just the Velvet Underground.
Like a horse easy on the bit, she was guided by the slightest intimation from him who held the rein. Indeed, it sometimes appeared as if the reins were dropped, and the inferior animal were left to the guidance of her own sagacity.
Oof. Scathing.
The juxtaposition of this portrait with the scene that follows, a scene in which the Winthrops make a crucial political error in providing Indian diplomats with sustenance presented, quote, in a manner so inferior to the principal board as to indicate that it was destined for inferior guests. Both disputes the patriarchal judgment of inferiority and the creates another link between Native Americans and white women. Significantly, the Indians refuse to partake of the meal until the injustice is remedied, and their refusal gains them equal treatment in respect. Moreover, it is fully apparent throughout the novel, indeed throughout Sedgwick's body of work, that symbols of restraint used in conjunction with marriage are an indication of the suspect nature of that institution.
Mm.
Governor Winthrop states that he is, quote, impatient to put jesses on this wild bird. And we also have this quoted. Impatient to put jesses on his wild on this wild bird while she is on our perch. I'm going to stop there. But do you guys have anything you want to add?
More grotesque animal imagery and
Well, it just shows how controlling the project is that Winthrop has been put in charge of, and that every man and every household in that colony is deputized to do that. You literally have to put blinders on the women around you, or like the people who aren't you around you, if you're to follow that analogy through. And the amount of internal freedom that characters like Mago Wiska have, they're an anomaly for these people because it's this top-down totalitarian control, like every bit of your life.
Yeah. Yeah, and I just think it is sort of interesting how Sedgwick, she'll come in at and editorialize at a number of places, but she never says, by the way, isn't it weird how all these patriarchal decisions end up turning out very poorly?
Well, it reminds me of that meme when it's that goes around on Twitter when a right-wing person gives away the game a little bit and says something truly reprehensible, or they say what they mean, essentially, and then someone quote tweets it, and it's like, when they tell you who they are, believe them.
Yeah.
So like, when you look at the analogies that these people use, like, believe them and what they say, that they want to enslave you.
You better hope that the opposition to Antifa doesn't mobilize folks.
Yeah. The notorious pho.
Yeah, that pho, whatever that is, that pho, I certainly don't know.
I do have a lot of questions about her allegiances in this novel, especially when you consider the scene that I don't think we'll cover in this episode, but the most problematic scene in the novel, which is when Hope sees Faith in her new clothing and she's repulsed by it. And Sedgwick doesn't editorialize. She just shows us Hope's repulsion and kind of leaves it out there. And I think one of the essays we read, I forget who wrote it, but makes an argument that actually she, just because she's not editorializing and pulling us out of the scene and kind of telling us what she thinks, she's still consciously like showing us things that she knows we're gonna respond to.
Right.
So like, and she's kind of trusting us to respond in the right way.
Yeah, yeah. I think the word specifically, and I don't know if this is in one of the essays I shared, but one of them makes specific note on the word revolted. It says Hope was revolted by the appearance of her sister in the Native American garb. And revolt, especially, 50 years following the American mm-hmm. Revolution, has a number of different connotations.
Mm. Yep.
And so you can read that is she's just disgusted by it simply. That's the on the surface reading. But I do think, I think it probably is a bit more complicated than that. Particularly when you know what we know about Eunice Williams.
And how does she end that paragraph that you just read, Matt? She says something like, I will leave it to the reader to ascertain her flaws, because she's my favorite.
Yes.
And I'm not going to tell you her flaws.
Yeah, yeah.
And I feel like that is quite explicitly foreshadowing that scene.
Mm. Mm.
Where right. It's like, actually, I am going to come to realize that this character who I've put so much faith in is deeply flawed right. and a product of her times and her conditions, and we can't possibly expect her to not react to her sister in that way.
I think that's a good reading.
It just shows an incredible amount of maturity and understanding of control for her as a writer.
Mm.
That where she's like, I'll be explicit when I choose to be explicit, and you can follow me because I'm going this way or not.
Yeah.
Or someone like Fenimore Cooper can't help but tell you how he feels.
Oh, so didactic.
Every single yep. page.
Yeah. Let's see. I want to maybe skip. I guess we've kind of covered Winthrop. I'm going to throw one of those out of there.
How many hours are we going to talk about this guy?
Yeah. Mrs. Winthrop, I mean.
Oh,
the horse on the bit.
Yeah, we kind of got that, unless you think we should go back into it. Okay.
Let's move on from that.
Yeah. And now here we have Everill finally returning from the UK in a boat. He's in Boston Harbor with a strange man and the strange man's assistant, who is a beautiful young boy.
Yeah.
Boy.
With curly hair
and a beautiful face.
His head.
And he's breaking sumptuary laws. Because he's too fancy dressed.
Mr. Too Damn Sumptuary.
But I don't know if we'll even get to that part. This is when, this is Everill and Gardner who makes his appearance, who's unidentified as the stranger here. They're rowing into Boston Harbor, approaching Boston, and they talk about politics. And this isn't exactly, this isn't so on theme with what we've been talking about so far, but I thought it was one of the more interesting things, especially with the commodity that, the guy takes a special liking to that Winthrop is not getting in the way of.
Mm-hmm.
Whilst the boat, impelled by a favoring tide and fair breeze, glided rapidly toward the metropolis of the now thriving colony, the gentleman fell into conversation with the pilot. The elder stranger inquired if Governor Winthrop had been reelected. "Yes, God bless him," replied the sailor. "The worthy gentleman has taken the helm once again." "Has he," asked the stranger eagerly, "declared for king or parliament?" "Oh, I don't know much about their land tackle," replied the seaman, "but to my mind, the fastings we have all had along when the king won the day, and the rejoicings when the parliament gained it, was what you might call a declaration. Since you speak of it, I do remember I heard the boys up in the town saying that our magistrates, at election, did scruple about the oath, and concluded to leave out that part which promises to bear true faith and allegiance to our sovereign lord King Charles. So we have thrown his majesty overboard, and are to sail under parliament colors," said the young gentleman. "Well," he continued, "this might have been predicted some 5 or 6 years since, for I remember there were then disputes whether the king's ensign should be spread there," and he pointed to the fortifications on Castle Island, past which the boat was at the moment gliding. "They scruple now about the oath. Then their consciences rebelled against the red cross in the ensign, which, I remember, was called the Pope's gift, a relic of papacy, an idolatrous sign, etc." I don't have much to say, but the Catholicism here is interesting to me, especially in the context of a sort of French and Canadian vibe, right? Like,
I hadn't really appreciated the extent to which, because of French imperialism in this on this continent, that Catholicism was, especially for the colonial period, something that was associated, especially with a lot with upstate Native Americans, even, which is the Native American that Eunice Williams, Sedgwick's ancestor, married was a Catholic Mohawk. I don't know exactly that comes more into play later on. There's some plays on Catholic imagery and the Virgin Mary.
And Onico is Catholic eventually, no?
Oh, I haven't caught that, but that's possible.
I think he and Faith. There's a section towards the end where it's like, it's okay. She's kind of Christian.
Ah,
you know, she's retained something, or
right, you know, which would even draw the parallel to Eunice
even closer. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Wait, so what year is this? This is 1637. 37. So this is the height of sectarian religious violence in Europe at that time.
Now we're at 42. So the
but 30 to 40 have been. The 40 years war would have just been, or 30 years war would have just been wrapping up. But you look at like the Jesuits were created like in the Inquisition era as like the shock troops for the Counter Reformation, and they were sent through Europe and then also through America as a way of like we're engaging in this like battle in Christendom, and we're gonna like up it to 11. So going around like the Americas, it became just another battlefield for this. Idea or this battle of ideas that was also quite violent. So I think a Protestant nation running into like a Catholic, and especially like a Native American Catholic or something, which is someone who'd been converted by a Jesuit, would be like someone being an analogy would be someone converted to Nazism by like an SS officer. Saying that those are morally equivalent. I'm just saying like for like the revulsion of someone,
or like a ISIS Mexican laborer.
That's actually much better. yeah which they are terrified about at any given moment.
Imagine if that happens, Trump's gonna be super concerned. Scruples of conscience are ever honorable, said the elder stranger, and doubtless your governor has good reason for not complying with the scripture rule, render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's. "There is no doubt of it," replied the seaman. "The governor, God bless him, knows the rules of the good book as well as I know the ropes of a ship, and there is no better pilot than he for all weathers, as he shows by not joining in the hue and cry against the good creature tobacco. Fair winds through life, and a pleasant harbor at last, do I wish him for this piece of Christian love." Now that is sort of the, first of all, he knows the ropes. Is a very like establishment type of this person has executive experience, okay? Yeah. So maybe they should be president. And then also, by the way, they're going to let us smoke, guys. So, At the same time, he illustrated his benediction by putting a portion of the favorite luxury in his mouth. "I am sorry," said the young gentleman, "that our magistrates have volunteered a public expression of their feelings. Their sympathies, of course, are with the Parliament party. They virtually broke the yoke of royal authority when they left their native land, and showed what value they set on liberty by sacrificing for it every temporal good. Now they have a right to enjoy their liberty and peace." "Peace," said the elder gentleman emphatically. "Thus it is ever with the natural man, crying peace, peace, where there is no peace. Think you, young man, that if the king were to recover his power, he would not resume all the privileges that he has formerly granted to these people, who, thanks to him whose ark abideth with them, show themselves so ready to cast off their allegiances?" "The king, no doubt," replied the young gentleman, "would like to resume both power and possession, but still I think we might retain our own, on the principle that he had no right to give, and in truth could not give, what was not his, and what we have acquired either by purchase of the natives or by lawful conquest, which gives us the right to the vacuum domicilium." Now that's one of my
vocab words.
But we also see that Everill talking, is more attuned to, you know, let's make sure we're not completely fucking over the Native Americans. That was Gardner who said, "It's always people crying peace, peace, where there is no peace." Where else would you cry peace, though? Where there is peace? That was my question.
Like that. That's the type of thing that sounds smart from a conservative or right wing or pro war or whatever you want to call it angle. Like, oh, look at all these non-realistic people crying peace, peace where there's not peace.
I think his criticism is that the speakers who are demanding peace are getting it through unjust means, through non-peaceful ways.
Oh, okay. I thought he was saying people shouldn't be calling for peace because it's time for war.
Yeah, he's a cynic.
Yeah, but yeah, I think that Everil doesn't understand, or he thinks that Everil doesn't understand that he's part of a larger game of exploitation, especially when he incites these like rights of man. That's why, like, well, of course the people were right to revolt against their king. It wasn't his rights to grant anyways. And then he flips it and goes, now the way we've done it over here is by the lawful conquest, which is like military intelligence, essentially.
Yeah, that's a fun word. That's a fun phrase. Lawful conquest.
Yeah, you've just like intellectualized the same kind of barbarity that you are saying the king had no right to do, essentially.
We call it the lawful conquest states of America.
He's also framed as a kind of somewhat corrupt, cynical older man encountering an naive young romantic, and kind of putting him in his place.
Right. Okay, so a couple more things here just to start. Let's go, we'll do one in chapter 10, one in chapter 11, one in chapter 12. So basically, Everil and Gardner enter Boston. Everil accepts Gardner's request to kind of show him around and avail on his connections in Boston, and immediately they meet up with Hope and Esther. And they go to this dinner, and dinner with Native Americans that we mentioned earlier, that Winthrop fucks up because he doesn't set the table nicely enough, and insults the Indian guests, who make a point themselves of saying, "Hey, when we invite you over, we let you sleep in the or let you you know sit in the sachem's chair, right?" So like, come on, what's going on here?
Doesn't his wife kind of take the blame for that?
I don't know if she takes the blame, but they fix it at least.
Mm.
Like, it's the women who are like, oh, we need to sort this out, basically. But as they're preparing to sort of get ready for this, we have a part, and we mentioned this in the last episode, how unkind Sedgwick is to Jeanette, the maid, basically. And this is where she just editorializes on Jeanette for a couple minutes. "No, Jeanette, bring me my pink bodice and my ruby locket." Jeanette obeyed, but not without muttering as she left the room, a remonstrance against the vanities of dress. Jeanette was one of those persons, abounding in every class of life, whose virtues are most conspicuous in damning sins they are not inclined to. It's nice of her to say not every class, because it does seem kind of like this is a class issue.
Yeah,
right.
"We ought, perhaps, to apologize for obtruding so humble and disagreeable a personage upon our readers. But the truth is, she figured too much on the family record of the Fletchers to be suppressed by their faithful historian. Those personages, yclept bores in the copious vocabulary of modern times, seem to be a necessary ingredient in life, and like pinching shoes and smoky rooms, constitute a portion of its trials."
Oh, I love that.
Jeanette had first found favor with Mrs. Fletcher from her religious exterior. To employ none but godly servants was a rule of the pilgrims, and there was a certain set of phrases and modes of dress which produced no slight impression upon the minds of the credulous. To do Jeanette justice, she had many temporal virtues, and though her religion was of a ritual order, and therefore particularly disagreeable to her spiritual mistress, yet her household faculties were invaluable, for then, as now, in the interior of New England, a faithful servant was like the genius of a fairy tale. No family could hope for more than one. Long possession legalized Jeanette's rights and increased her tyrannical humors, which were naturally most freely exercised on those members of the family who had grown from youth to maturity under her eye. In nothing was the sweetness of Hope Leslie's temper more conspicuous than in the perfect good nature with which she bore the teasing impertinences of this menial, who, like a cross cur, was ready to bark at every passer-by.
This reminds me so much.
This menial cross cur.
Yeah.
Like a cross cur, a upset dog. Yeah.
This reminds me so much of in Rip Van Winkle, when they couldn't help but just dunk on Rip Van Winkle's wife over and over and over again, how boring she was.
She was only in the story for that purpose.
Yeah, there's got to be some sort of like, we've got a coin. If it doesn't exist in this room, we have to coin some like literary trope term where it's the author being like, listen, I don't want to bring up this character either. I hate this character, but I'm going to try to give you like a vague understanding of this person. And it's just an absolute crucifixion the whole way through. It's like, let's just get past this as quick as possible because I don't like this character either. But get this. They suck like from beginning to end.
But she does that so much to the point where you almost think she's trying to signal that her narrator is flawed.
Mm.
And especially reading this book a second time, I have so much more, if not sympathy for Jeanette, then I'm shocked at how cruel the portrayal is.
Right.
And there's something.
And it's just starting, folks.
Oh, yeah. Right. But, you know, in the kind of deep moral logic of this novel, like if you really zoom out and read it in a very allegorical way, it makes a lot of sense that the most morally redundant character is also the one who is in the service of this family. Like, she's kind of, in some ways, enslaved.
Right.
Like, here it says, long possession legalized her right and increased her tyrannical humors.
Mm.
And we know that Sedgwick is very much a believer in people's conditions and the way they are treated having a direct impact on their moral qualities. So, I don't know.
Yeah, no, I think, especially if you're looking for little, like, signals or hints when she prefaces the diatribe by being like, this is not about class. It's almost like, it's so on the nose, it's almost like a wink to be like, wait, all this is about class.
Yeah.
Right. And we also see that there are characters who are treated much worse than Jeanette is, who are much better people. Like all of the Indians.
Mm.
You know, they've endured so much more than she has, and they still manage to be good people.
And I think that's almost where you get like the class and race issue, which actually, if you want to defend this using historical grounds, it's that this is, and we mentioned last week, a sort of like the lower orders, I guess you would call it, were especially harsh on the Indian servants because that they didn't have a whole lot to distinguish them besides that, right? So like you're going to start intruding on my domestic service. Well, what's like there has to be some difference between me and you, and that's ultimately, I think, that rub indentured servitude meets racialized slavery is how America gets to be as racist and or racist in the way that it is.
And there's also a little bit of the kind of liberal romanticization of the other and the kind of noble savage idea coming from the European Enlightenment that she's channeling in some of these portrayals of the Indians, I think.
Yeah, I feel like their portrayals, her portrayals of Native Americans are always allowed a certain amount of room to have dignity in a way that Jeanette has none.
Right. Even when they're being cruel, they are given dignity, whereas she's a petty slave, basically.
Yeah, she's just like a fly in like all our faces.
Yeah. that like tells on you.
We never hear what she looks like either, which is interesting.
Yeah, a dog that's barking, we heard.
A cross cur,
yeah. All right, so for the home stretch of this episode, we're going to go to the home of the Winthrops. Hope was sent to the Winthrops because she helped Megawiska escape, and Pynchon knew that. Didn't really confront her about it. She didn't get in trouble, but it's like, we better send you. Fletcher is like, we need to send you to the Winthrops because you're not really behaving yourself. Chapter 11 has this description of the Winthrop Manor, which it reminded me of in Scarlet Letter when we go to the, I forget what the name of the character was, but the Governor Bellingham's mansion. And the description of, I mean, these interior, this is, I like to put in the genre of MTV Cribs, right? This is just the early MTV Cribs. And so here is MTV Cribs, Catherine Maria Sedgwick.
Well, there's that, and it's also like, where does this, in that one in particular, or in Scarlet Letter in particular, in this one, incidentally, it's a great device for an author to be like, where is this project coming from? Like, where is this project of colonial expansion coming from, and you get this visual image of how long the trail of history is behind these people who are showing up, that this project has been centuries in the making, and these people have been like hammered out to be these foot soldiers for expansion and control.
Mm-hmm. And I also think of it like the type of what's represented and how something newly represented in a medium can be exciting. Like, this is the first movie about Mars, or this is the first
rocking chair.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Or it's like, you know, it's the Zuckerberg Social Network isn't that big interesting of a movie, but it's the first thing that showed you behind the sort of curtain there, right? And this and in fiction, it's sort of a similar thing where it's like, oh, this is how else would you hear about what's inside of this sort of highly, you know, prestigious private abode, basically.
Mm-hmm.
The mighty master of fiction has but to wave the wand of his office to.
This is a reference to either Cooper or Walter Scott. Have you read Walter Scott?
No.
Yeah, neither have I. But he was very big influence on all these like early 19th century writers.
The mighty master of fiction has but to wave the wand of his office to present the past to his readers with all the vividness and distinction of the present. But we who follow him at an immeasurable distance, we who have no magician's enchantments, wherewith we can imitate the miracles wrought by the rod of the prophet, we must betake ourselves to the compass and the rule, and set forth our description as minutely and exactly as if we were making out an inventory for a salesman. In obedience to this necessity, we offer the following detailed description of the internal economy of a pilgrim mansion, not on any apocryphal authority, but quoted from an authentic record of the times. In the principal houses was a great hall ornamented with pictures, a great lantern, velvet cushions in the window seat to look into the garden, on either side a great parlor, a little parlor or study, furnished with great looking glasses, Turkey carpets, window curtains and valance, picture and a map, a brass clock, red leather back chairs, a great pair of brass andirons, the chambers well furnished with feather beds, warming pans, and every other elegance and comfort. The pantry well filled with substantial fare and dainties, Madeira wine, prunes, marmalade, silver tankards, and wine cups not uncommon. If any are incredulous as to the correctness of the above extract, we assure them that its truth is confirmed by the spaciousness of the pilgrim habitation still standing in Boston, and occupied by their descendants. These pilgrims were not needy adventurers, nor ruined exiles. Mr. Winthrop himself had an estate in England, worth £700 per annum. Some of his associates came from lordly halls, and many of them brought wealth, as well as virtue, to the colony. The rigor of the climate and the embarrassments incident to their condition often reduced the pilgrims in their earliest period to the wants of extreme poverty, but their sufferings had the dignity and merit of being voluntary, and are now, as tattered garments of the saints are to the faithful, sacred in the eyes of their posterity. Our humble history has little to do with the public life of Governor Winthrop, which is so well known to have been illustrated by the rare virtue of disinterested patriotism, and by such even and paternal goodness, that a contemporary witty satirist could not find it in his heart to give him a harsher name than Sir John Temperwell.
Meh. Yeah.
Long wind-up, but
not exactly. Yeah, not exactly the disinterested patriot, but the description of the house I thought was fairly interesting for its the ornate. What was ornate at that time, and almost demystifying, right? Like, I mean, it's hard for me to put. I guess what is the current example would be like Bill Gates's house or something like that, and it's just like, what do they have access to? What can they get, and what are the valuables there? But like, it's, I feel like I don't care anymore at all. But I feel like at this point there was still some mystery and majesty about it.
I think there was some majesty in how closely you could recreate your life back in England. Mm-hmm. It like showed because it could insinuate like some sort of like royalty connection or connection with power by like, look at this chair and look at this wine I have. These are all imports that they're talking about.
Right.
And I think that's the whole idea behind so many of these colonies is how quickly can we recreate home again? As we learned, can't be transferred. Can't be done, folks.
But can it? Like, no. it kind of can be transferred if you've got your prunes and your marmalade and...
No. Well, we'll see how this novel ends.
So yeah, I guess just to wrap up, we can sort of set the table for the for volume two, which is again on the theme of the hands-onness of the patriarchy. We have Mr. Fletcher and Winthrop discussing Hope and how they should try to marry her off. Mr. Fletcher takes issue with Winthrop trying to marry her off to Gardner. This is, of course, after Winthrop suggested Hubbard, the historian. And Mr. Fletcher is very protective of his favorite Hope because, after all, he is the daughter of the woman that he actually loved.
Such a tenuous connection, but he's like, I love her more than my
she's
kids.
In the well, she's in the image, right? That's the phrase.
It looks it's like if my girlfriend was a child.
Yeah, exactly. Here's the argument between the two patriarchs. Hath he credentials to verify all these parts? Mr. Fletcher asking Winthrop about Gardner's credentials. Hath he credentials to verify all these particulars? Governor Winthrop colored slightly at the interrogatory that implied a deficiency of wariness on his part, and replied that he thought the gentleman scarcely needed other than he carried in his language and deportment, but that he had come furnished with letter of introduction, satisfactory in all points. From whom? Inquired Mr. Fletcher. From one Jeremy Austin, who expresseth himself as, and Sir Philip says is, a warm friend to us. Is he known to you? No, but I think I have heard him mentioned as a well-willer to our colony. This was not perfectly satisfactory to Mr. Fletcher, but he forbore to press the point further, and turned his attack to the part of the suggestion that appeared most vulnerable. Methinks, he said, you are over hasty in proposing to match Hope Leslie with this stranger. Nay, I meant not a formal proposition. I noted that Sir Philip was struck with Hope's outward graces. He is an uncommon personable man, and hath that bearing that finds favor in a maiden's eyes, and the thought came to me that he may have been sent here in good time to relieve all our perplexities. And to confess the truth, brother, if I may use the sporting language of our youth, I am impatient to put jesses on this wild bird of yours while she is on our perch. But to be serious, and surely the subject does enforce us to it, I am satisfied that you will not oppose any means that may offer to secure the lambs of our flock in the true fold. I shall oppose nothing that will promote the spiritual prosperity of those dear to me as my own soul. I have no reason to doubt my son's filial obedience. He hath never been wanting, and though both he and I have fallen under censure, I see not that I erred in sending him from me, since I but complied with the last request of his sainted mother, and that compliance deprived me of the only child left of my flock. I speak not vauntingly, but let not those who have remained in Egypt condemn him who has drank of the bitterest waters of the wilderness. So this is just to catch people up. He sent Everill to the UK because Mrs. Fletcher, before she was killed, asked him if he would do that for his education. And Winthrop doesn't want Everill to marry Hope because it will look the way it will look in the community because Hope has a lot of money to inherit. And Everill's like, I don't care about money, but we won't. That exchange is not in this. Mr. Fletcher, finding himself again yielding to irrepressible emotions, rose and hastily left his more equal-tempered and less interested friend. Thus did these good men, not content with their magnanimous conflict with necessary evils, involve themselves in superfluous trials. Whatever gratified the natural desires of the heart was questionable, and almost everything that was difficult and painful assumed the form of duty.
as if the benevolent father of all had stretched over our heads a canopy of clouds. Instead of the bright firmament and its glorious host and ever-changing beauty, and had spread under our feet a wilderness of bitter herbs, instead of every tree and plant yielding its good fruit. But we would fix our eyes on the bright halo that encircled the pilgrim's head, and not mark the dust that sometimes sullied his garments. End of chapter 11.
There you go.
Hmm.
So yeah, that is where we stand. To close out chapter 12, Esther and Hope go to a lecture at a church that bores Hope to tears because she's preoccupied because she has some meeting to get to.
Mm.
And we never find out what that meeting is until volume 2.
Very early on when we were talking about her Indian relatives, her kind of connections, historically in her family, I was wondering if we were going to talk about whether it's possible to read this novel as Sedgwick kind of working out her feelings of guilt and complicity through her family.
Right.
And just given the parallels, like, I think it's... Where does they say? Yeah, it's kind of too much to get into, actually. Maybe next time. It's rather a large conversation.
Yeah, I mean, the only thing I can say about that specifically that's come up in the reading is in Weirman, she mentions how Sedgwick was tasked by, I think, relatives to write a biography or was an autobiography. Let me see if I can. Yeah, and in Weirman it says she wasn't exactly the best at coming to grips with some of the more systemic, especially the failures with the sort of mission schools and why those failed. She isn't quite able to come to full terms with it.
Yeah, like there are limits to her kind of empathy.
Yeah.
But in the last paragraph of that essay, she says that we see a well-intentioned writer challenged by a shameful family history of Indian mistreatment, confronting her own privilege, which is interesting. I mean, she's definitely confronting it. Whether she fully works it out.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Is a question.
Right.
Yeah. I think you can't help but compare it to Hawthorne's Scarlet Letter, which comes from a similar background.
Right. With the witch trials.
Yeah. His family is of such a prominent place in Salem.
Mm-hmm.
But he doesn't wrestle with that nearly as, in my opinion, seriously as Sedgwick seems to do.
Yeah.
To really look at the truth and let it look back at her in a way that Hawthorne is like, really going to tell a story about her, like, individuality for the most part.
He sort of crystallizes it into something more, like, more ornamental or...
Sort of reifies it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Sedgwick really complexifies things, I think, quite a bit.
Yeah.
Well, guys, this has been a long one, but I think this will be our final Hope Leslie episode for a month or so. We're going to move on to some other things, and I'm going to finish doing the audiobook for Volume 2, but thank you once again, Grace and Alex, for being here.
Thank you. Of course.
Appreciate it very much, and we will see you... Let's just plug some things for a little bit more. Do you guys have Twitter profiles you want to plug?
I do. My Twitter is kind of overrun with China, which is my kind of other preoccupation.
Mm-hmm.
But my handle is Grace Jackson.
It's so simple.
Yep. I got that really early. And I've actually had people get in touch with me to ask if they can have it.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Really?
Yeah. Two people.
I wouldn't say it online, but your Gmail is also, like, you must have been one of the first people to get the address.
Yeah.
Because that's nuts.
Yeah, I was one of the people, like, I got 10 invites that I gave out to my friends because I was one of the Gmail early adopters.
Yeah. It was Trump2016 at gmail.com. It's nuts.
It was spooky. And then Alex Guns, Alex with CKS.
Yep. _CKS_GUNS.
I've seen you described as Alex with CKS.
Yes, someone today was like, Alex, you were good on the show or something, and they did the ECKS. Yeah. That comes from My sisters and I just started telling our teachers once that our mother hates the letter X, just gaslighting our own mother. Yeah. For some religious reason, like she doesn't like X for some religious reason. I would go by A-L-E-C-K-S, and now there's people referring to me like to that on Twitter. So thankfully my mother just will take it in stride. But yeah, just one more way that we drive our parents insane. for fun.
That's that Iowa fun.
Yeah, that's a classic pre-television fun. Let's put it right with the
add that to
chair.
The list.
Yeah,
I want to recommend Alex's Twitter. It's full of literary tidbits.
Yeah, that's true.
Lots of good annotations and scholarly notes.
Yeah, there's really no reason there should be more people who follow Literary Hangover than me. I don't understand why that.
Yeah, Literary Hangover just grows and grows.
Yeah, mine just kind of sits there. That's fine, though. Not my problem.
How many do you have?
I don't know. Something like 323 or ooh, give or take nothing, because I know exactly how many followers I have.
Yeah, so if you are already following both Grace and Alex on Twitter, then your next step is to subscribe to Literary Hangover on Patreon. Patreon.com/literary hangover. I'm going to be releasing the narrations at any level of payment. So if you're only paying $1 a month, you will also have access to Hope Leslie and the future audiobooks that I produce. The four and $10, those are just encouraged and applauded, but do what you can. Patreon.com/literary hangover, also on YouTube and most places podcasts are available. We will see you again next time.